So happy 420 to everybody listening. It's March 20th and it's 420. And so it's the meme day where everybody, you know, everybody likes joking around. But today, it's one of the big joking days because it's 420. But unfortunately, today is 420, but the S&P 500 did not hit 4,200. And so, you know, at 20, right? Maybe as a joke, because there's so many jokes out there in the market, maybe, you know, maybe the people out there, the you know, market traders would be smart enough to close the market on around 4,200 points, you know, because 420 times 10 is 4,200. And so, unfortunately, that didn't happen. But, you know, all the markets, all the major indices closed a bit lower today. You know, they closed less than 1% lower today. And the treasury yields were pretty much unchanged. And usually when you have the indices closing lower, it's because of rising treasury rates or rising interest rates. The interest rates did not move and the markets were closing down lower than usual, which is kind of it's kind of a different situation here. And it might be indicating that the market optimism is falling. And so then maybe we're going to have to, or we're going to need to have some more announcements of fiscal or monetary, you know, stimulus to keep the markets raging. And, you know, another thing we have today is Doge did not hit 69 cents. You know, I saw a lot of people on Twitter, especially saying that, you know, Doge is going to 69 cents because it's 420, you know, so we're going to get double the memes, I guess. But it didn't hit 69 cents. I think it went up a bit, but it didn't hit the target. You know, maybe now it's trading at 30 something, 40 cents or so, which is, I mean, it's still crazy because, well, first of all, it shouldn't be worth anything. I mean, it was created as a joke, but apparently people are really getting the laugh of the joke. They find it quite funny. And so, you know, right now it's still gaining a little bit, but it, you know, it's not breaking through its meme goal. Now, some recent news that we just got, and this was really recent news, and it was the whole situation with Derek Chauvin and his trial. And so today he was officially convicted of second degree murder. He was convicted of third degree murder, and he was also convicted of manslaughter for killing George Floyd. Now, I think that, I mean, third degree murder, maybe, manslaughter, yes, but second degree murder, I don't think it makes any sense. And I'll tell you why, because if you look at the definition of second degree murder, it says a deliberate killing that occurs without prior planning. Now, I don't think he planned to kill George Floyd, obviously. I mean, there's really no argument for that. It's not like he, you know, was tracking down the guy. He had a GPS on him, or, you know, he had some past, you know, history with George Floyd, and he just wanted to kill him for some reason. You know, that'd be first degree murder, and it's obviously not that. But I don't think it's second degree murder either. Now, you know, first degree murder would be something like planning an assassination, or, you know, if you have some past history with someone and, you know, you hate them for some reason, then you just want to kill them. And you're planning out your whole strategy and what tools you're going to use and where you're going to kill them and all that, you know, that'd be first degree murder. But second degree murder is like if you go and rob a grocery store or rob a business, and then you get into a fight with a person, and then that ends up turning into, a bigger fight, and someone ends up dying from that fight. You know, that'd be second degree murder. with Derek Chauvin. I mean, okay, first of all, he's a police officer, and as a police officer, you're not really supposed to kill people, obviously. But you know, I don't think he was considering the method of killing George Floyd, because you know, if you wanted to deliberately kill someone, I mean, why would you kneel on their neck? You know, there's got to be much better ways of deliberately killing someone. I mean, you could just shoot them, and you know, to be honest, he probably would have died if you just tasered him. You know, he was on drugs. He had COVID. I mean, if you tasered him, there's a good chance he would have died there anyways. So, I mean, kneeling on his neck, first of all, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't seem like a way someone would kill someone deliberately. And, you know, an important question is, you know, what motive would you have for killing someone deliberately? You know, because second degree murder, you have to deliberately kill someone. And if you're going to kill someone, you have to have some type of motive. I mean, people don't just go around killing people for no reason. Now, you know, some people say he's a racist and he just hates black people, but I mean, there's really no evidence that shows that he's racist or he hates black people, right? I mean, he wasn't saying in the recording, he wasn't saying any like, you know, racist slurs. He wasn't, you know, he didn't even mention the fact that George Floyd was black. There was nothing racial going on. And, you know, maybe you could assume that he was just, you know, hiding it. But I mean, there's a ton of black people in America, right? Why do you find a random guy that, you know, you just happen to arrest and kill them? You could go around and shoot up a building, and, you know, you could go to a black neighborhood. And if you really hated blacks, if you really wanted to hate, you know, kill a lot of blacks, you could just go to a black neighborhood and, you know, start shooting people there. But of course, you know, that'd be first degree murder. But you have to have some type of motive, and in a second degree murder, it's kind of like the murder wasn't your initial purpose, but it ended up becoming that. But you know, you have to have a purpose for the thing, you know, doing whatever that became murder. You know, for example, if you go rob a store, your purpose is to rob a store. Your purpose is to get money. But I mean, you're not there to kill someone, and you end up killing someone. But for Derek Chauvin, I mean, there's really no reason. There's no initial motive that leads up to the killing of George Floyd. And so it doesn't make sense how you would charge him for second degree murder on a legal perspective. Now, I think a lot of it is politics. And I think giving him a second degree murder title would calm, you know, all these Black Lives Matter movements. And it would be a lot more, I guess, peaceful in the streets. So, but I don't think it's a very fair trial. I don't think it's too honest. And I don't think he should get a second degree murder for, you know, I think it should be manslaughter or maybe third degree murder as well. But I don't think second degree I don't think he deserves that. And also I want to get away with politics and talk a little bit more about economics and finance and this type of stuff. And so I was reading a CNBC article, and it was about Wood Mackenzie, who's some energy researcher / consultant. And so what I saw in the article is Wood Mackenzie said that oil prices could hit $10 a barrel in 2025 if the Paris Climate Accords, you know, the goals are reached. And I thought that was the funniest thing I've ever read. Well, maybe not ever read, because I've read some funny things, but you know, it's one of the most, I mean, I don't know how to describe it. It's the most like clueless comments I've ever read. It's gotta be up there. Oil prices hitting $10 a barrel. Look, first of all, I don't think that's how it works, because look, if the demand for oil drops, you know, by 90%, let's say, or whatever percent, that doesn't mean that oil prices drop by 90 or 70 or 80%. No, oil demand could drop by, I think, 90, 80%, and the price would the price would drop, but it wouldn't drop past a certain threshold. And the reason for that is because there's a cost to producing oil. You know, there's first of all, you know, setting up all the drills and setting up all the, you know, prior stuff and you know, the exploration, which all this costs a lot of money. There's the financing, and then, you know, you got to pay back the interest on the debt, and there's all that, which costs a lot of money. But there's also the cash costs of drilling the oil and mining the oil, and, you know, actually being able to get the oil out of the ground. You know, there's a per barrel cost to that too. And I could tell you, I mean, I don't know the exact number, but it's a lot higher than $10 a barrel. So there's no way that oil could, you know, stay at $10 a barrel for any reasonable amount of time. Now, oil, the price of oil did go negative, you know, back in 2020, and, you know, during the recession. But I mean, that was because of the whole futures market trading thing. And that's because people didn't have anywhere to store their oil. So, you know, they were buying all these oil future contracts. And so, you know, when people came and were delivering the oil, the people who bought the paper oil didn't want the physical oil. And so, I mean, they didn't have anywhere to store it. And so they had to get rid of it. And so apparently it traded at negative prices. Now, I don't think anybody really was able to buy oil at negative $37 a barrel, or at least buy any substantial amount of it, because it's just such a, I mean, it's the time period that it lasted at negative prices was so small that no big, let's say, holders of cash was able to buy it. They just didn't have the time to. And so, I mean, there's no way the prices of oil could last that long, that low for that long. And I think what's even more important is that no companies would produce oil for $10 a barrel, right? No company will keep on selling oil for $10 a barrel. Now, if the demand for oil dropped 90% by 2025 or whatever percent by 2025, what would happen is a lot of oil companies would go out of business. A lot of oil companies would shut down, and, you know, the volume of oil, you know, the trading volume would shrink substantially, but the price of oil I could see it staying the same. At $60, I think it's a pretty, you know, pretty reasonable price target for oil. Now, that all depends on how low the currency unit goes, because by 2025, if you think $10 today is still going to be worth $10, then you're way too optimistic on the whole, you know, US dollar. And you know what happens? You know, maybe by 2025, oil isn't even trading in US dollars. You know, maybe some other type of currency is going to replace the dollar. You know, the petrodollar? Is it going to be the petro yuan? Is it going to be the euro petro, the petro euro? Is it going to be, you know, what is it going to be? Or is it just going to be, you know, many, many oil markets trading in many, many currencies? Who knows? 2025, it's hard to say, but what you could know is that it's not going to $10 because people, companies just won't produce and sell oil for that low. And when oil was trading at negative, people who were selling oil were the for negative prices. They were the oil traders. They weren't the big oil companies. They weren't the producers of oil. The oil producers weren't selling their reserves of oil for negative money. What they do is they just hold it, and they just keep it and save it. They don't sell it for prices that they can't even make a profit off of, unless they need it to kind of finance their debt or something like that. But it's very rare that they'll sell it for incredibly low prices, and it's impossible that they'll pay you to buy their oil, because if they need money to finance their debt, their short-term debt or their interest payments, and then they need to sell their oil reserves for a small sum of money, they're not going to pay you to do that. That's just completely counterproductive in every way possible. So I mean, there's no way that oil is hitting $10 a barrel by 2025, whether or not the Paris Climate Accord, whether or not that works out. And again, look at who the big users of oil are. Countries like China, India, Russia, and of course the United States. But even if the U.S. did go through the Paris Climate Accord, China, India, Russia, do you think these guys are going to be completely on board? And so just $10 a barrel of oil is just completely silly. And if you look at the producers of oil, if oil goes to $10, the producers are all going to use oil, right? Nobody's, gonna just sit on their big oil reserve and not take advantage of it. Saudi Arabia, Russia, and China, if nobody wants oil and there's no cheaper, better way to to get energy, these guys are gonna use oil. But the whole economics of it is just completely, it's just completely flawed, because demand for, there's a threshold for how low oil can go for, a reasonable period of time, because then nobody produces it. And so, this thing was just, I don't know how to comment on it other than I thought it was really funny, but it's also really flawed. And, talking about oil prices and energy prices and all of this, I want to go back to early April, where the U.S. producer price index increased by 1% in March. And for this, I'm saying this because I thought of another way of looking at it. I just randomly thought of this, and I thought it might be very valuable. And it might be what actually ends up happening with inflation and all of this. And I think it's very, very underlooked by pretty much everybody who thinks of inflation and who believes inflation is coming. This aspect is, I think it's a very underlooked aspect, I guess. And I think it deserves a lot more attention. And so the PPI, the producer price index, in March increased 1%. Now the PPI is basically, it's kind of like the wholesale cost for producers. So like stuff like raw materials. And so instead of the CPI, which is the consumer price index, it's kind of like the CPI, but for, producers. 1% in March, so that's the greatest increase in 9.5 years. And, 1% in 1 month, that's a big increase. a lot of it, I think, is due to the increase in prices of natural resources and commodities. So if you look at the price of agriculture and energy, you'll see, you know, everything there is just rising very, very quickly. And if you look at some of the industrial metals like copper, a while ago, it was, you know, it had its big rise. And so I think you'll see a lot of, you know, producer price inflation happening there. And why that is important, and I think it's incredibly important, is usually when people think there's inflation, they think it's going to come from, you know, the fiscal spending and the rough monetary policies and, you know, keeping interest rates so low and the government sending all these checks and spending all this money and flowing into the real economy. And so, you know, there's more bank deposits, everybody has more money in their bank accounts. And so, you know, I think a lot of people think that this is going to be the thing that causes the inflation. And, you know, I think it is, but there is a difference between that and what I'm saying here, which I'll get into right away. And so, you know, the common view of inflation is this, it's this top-down view. So, you know, government and monetary policy, and so everybody has more money and everybody's going to spend more money, and that's going to, you know, make the prices go higher. But I think, I think that's a possible way that inflation could happen. But I think if you look at it from a bottom-up perspective, it's very, very interesting. And I think that could be how inflation starts, right? If you don't know when it's going to start, because finding the when is very, very difficult. But when and how it starts could maybe be found by looking at stuff bottom-up. And you see a lot of evidence of, you know, bottom-up inflation instead of kind of the top-down where, you know, it's fiscal spending, monetary policy. And I'll get to what bottom up is right away. First of all, you know, let me go back to top down actually. And so, you know, the government gave out around $6 trillion of fiscal stimulus, fiscal support ever since COVID-19. And, you know, it was mostly funded by debt and debt monetization from the Fed. And, you know, government was running all these large fiscal deficits, raising their trade deficits. And so that is an inflationary type of policy. Now, I guess trade deficit isn't really a policy, but, you know, that is eventually, it's eventually deflationary, unless if you use debt and debt monetization to get out of your trade, your eventual, let's say, need to go back into a trade surplus. But, the government gave out stimulus checks. And so that's like directly inflationary. And well, unless if people decide to save them or to pay back debt, but it's inflationary anyways, because not everybody's going to save them and pay back debt. So it's just a matter of how inflationary it actually is, but it is inflationary. And so, you know, there's more fiscal spending, and who knows, maybe there's more checks to come back in. There's talks about, you know, another COVID stimulus, and maybe we're going to get more checks. Maybe we're going to get more free money. And so that could be a possible event that happens. And if it does happen, then, you know, we could see worse inflation. And so, you know, a lot of people think these are going to cause inflation, but it could start off differently. And that's because too many people focus on the CPI and not the PPI. So what happens is, you know, my prediction is that maybe inflation is going to happen. It's going to start off from the PPI, the producer price index, rather than from the CPI, the consumer price index. And so what I mean is, you know, once the big commodity companies, once their reserves are depleted, you'll see an even bigger increase in the PPI than you did in March. And so, you know, what I mean is that, you know, big reserves, big commodity reserves are gathered and they're saved up during these periods of cheap commodity prices. And, you know, I was talking about that right before with the price of oil. You know, people don't sell oil when it's trading at $10 or, you know, negative prices. At least the big companies don't, usually, unless if they, again, got to, you know, finance their interest or something like that, which is quite rare anyways. But they don't usually sell their commodities when it's cheap. But once it becomes expensive, they'll start selling, or at least once it reaches a certain, you know, price that's high enough to actually have reasonable profit margins, they'll start selling their commodities. And, you know, right now, the big companies are selling. And what you see with that is that once the commodity reserves are depleted, you'll see that the prices on these commodities are going to go much, much higher because they don't produce these, you know, commodities that quickly. And, you know, it obviously takes some time to produce them. And so you're going to have the same demand. You're going to have a lot less supply, and all of the commodities are going to cost a lot more. And when you want all of this economic growth, you know, if we get an infrastructure plan and, you know, new innovation, new building, new manufacturing, whatever you want, you need these raw materials. You need the commodities, you need natural resources, you need energy, and you need industrial metals. But when these reserves become depleted, the cost, your raw material cost, increases substantially. And, you know, what happens when the PPI increases? You know, the prices for the producers increase, you know, their costs increase. Okay, well, these guys need to raise their prices as well. And that moves on to the CPI. It's, you know, it doesn't start from the CPI, but the producer prices move on to the CPI. The increased costs of these raw materials are transferred to the consumers. And, you know, a good example of this is if you look at the price of lumber, in pretty much a year, it's had around 85% growth, which is a lot of growth for the price of lumber. And if you also compare the growth, price, cost, growth and cost of stumpage, it hasn't grown much at all. Now, if you're wondering what stumpage is, it is the price that a, you know, private company or firm or whatever pays for the right to harvest timber from a given land. So, you know, it's paid to whoever owns the land. And, you know, you could see it as kind of like renting a place, except you get to harvest the stuff that is in the place. And, you know, in this case, it's trees. Stumpage is you know, you're harvesting the trees in a field or, you know, whatever land. And if you look at the price of stumpage or the cost of stumpage, first of all, it's usually based off of, you know, like per tree, you have to pay this much or whatever. That's how it's usually measured. But if you look at the stump bases, it's at 10-year lows. And, you know, that's the price of what it costs to, you know, get a tree. And, you know, basically, you know, that's where, you know, the main costs of getting lumber, at least the base costs of lumber comes from. And in some places it's at 10-year lows. But if you look at the price of lumber, I mean, it's crazy high right now. And so you have this huge spread between the prices of lumber and the prices of stumpage, or the fee price of stumpage. And I mean, that's just caused by low reserves and high demands of lumber. And that's what you'll have with all of the other commodities as well, if you don't increase the reserves, because the demand for these commodities they're not low. Now, they're not, you know, stupidly high, but they're not low. And I mean, the reserves, you know, these guys just came out of a cycle. It's kind of a cycle where commodities didn't, you know, for around 7 years or so, commodities didn't really do that well. They just kind of sat there. They dropped from their all-time high. They just kind of sat there, and not at a price where companies can make a big profit anyways. So these guys were saving up reserves. But when the reserves are depleted, like they are with lumber, I mean, the cost of producing these commodities, or mining or drilling or whatever, they stay pretty much the same. But there are so few reserves, and, you know, that the cost of buying the actual commodity itself becomes so high that now the producers need to, you know, increase their costs. And by increasing their costs, they need to pass it down to their consumers. And, you know, for lumber, I think a lot of it is due to, you know, the high demand to build homes. Now, the high demand to build homes causes home prices to go higher. And the high price of lumber also causes home prices to go higher. And then home prices go higher, and then people want to buy homes. And then that causes the price of lumber to go even higher. And then the price of homes go even higher. And so you have this very dangerous inflationary kind of self-perpetuating cycle that happens in rising house prices and lumber. And, you know, what you get with this is, while people are happy that the prices of their homes are going up, at least people who own homes are, renters and people who don't own homes, those guys are not happy at all. But people forget that, you know, your house is not only an asset, but it's also something that, you know, it's also something like a good. And I mean, look, people are mad when the price of food, or the price of, you know, gasoline, or the price of whatever, computers, go up. But, you know, they're mad. But when the price of homes or their stocks go up, I mean, they're happy. You know, that's like the best thing that happens to their financial well-being. The price of my home went up 15% this year. And they're all happy about that, but they don't look at it in a way where, you know, maybe the price of clothing went up 15% this year. That'd be terrible for everybody. Everybody would hate that. And, you know, when there's a discount on clothing, 15% off, you know, people aren't like, oh no, the price of clothes went down 15%. That's terrible news. But people are like, you know, that's great. But if, you know, if the price of clothing went up 15% on a given day, well, you know, if the little tag wasn't 15% off. It was 15% on or 15% extra. I mean, nobody would want that. But, you know, for housing, I guess, and stocks, I guess it's different because everybody wants more expensive, you know, higher priced assets. But it's not the same for you know, consumable goods or services. Everybody wants cheap, you know, stuff, and everybody wants expensive assets. And, you know, well, that's causing this self-perpetuating housing price increase to keep on, you know, rising. And, you know, the price of lumber, because of it, keeps on rising as well. And, well, it's obviously not going to last forever, especially where I am in Canada. I mean, the housing prices here are kind of ridiculous. But, I mean, it could go on for another year, another 2 years. I don't know how long it could go to. But, you know, if this type of inflation, housing inflation, moves on to other commodities, if lumber, if, you know, if it's not lumber, but it's some other commodity that the companies, the big companies who produce that commodity, if their reserves are depleted as well, well, what ends up happening? You know, what ends up happening is that, you know, the housing inflation could happen to other, you know, companies. You know, what if Walmart was housing? Well, they're going to, you know, everyday low prices. Well, I mean, they're going to raise their prices every day. And, you know, what's scary is that housing inflation could become CPI inflation. It could, you know, CPI inflation could just be a repeat of housing inflation, because, you know, housing inflation is kind of self-perpetuating, but CPI inflation is self-perpetuating as well. People see, you know, rising prices, and, you know, they're all afraid that inflation's coming. Right now, the inflation fears are at pretty high levels. So if the, you know, PPI increases and all these companies are forced to increase their prices for their goods because of the increase in raw material prices, and, you know, then the prices of goods and services could increase without governments having to do anything. And that all starts from the, you know, commodity extracting mining companies running low on reserves. And that happens because, you know, they're selling their reserves for, I guess you could call it a underpriced price, which is kind of where we're at right now. If that happens, you'll get a lot of PPI inflation, which could eventually translate into CPI inflation. And you're seeing that already with Coca-Cola. The Coca-Cola CEO not too long ago said that the Coca-Cola will raise their prices to offset higher commodity costs. So you're seeing that already with Coca-Cola. And, you know, I think a lot of other companies are to follow. I mean, look, Coca-Cola, why do they need a lot of commodities? I guess their cans are made out of aluminum. But, I mean, if you look at a company that uses a lot more metal, that's not Coca-Cola. You know, let's say it's like a car manufacturing company, or it's just another company that uses a ton of, you know, metals because they have to, their prices are going to raise a lot more than Coca-Cola's will. And Coca-Cola's already doing it. So, you know, this is a really different way of looking at where inflation starts. And again, in increasing the money supply will definitely cause and worsen inflation, but that might not be how inflation is really started. So I think this whole episode was very, very important. And I think it really gave a good insight in how I think inflation could be started. Now, of course, all this monetary fiscal policies, all of them are going to worsen the inflation problem. But I think that might not be where inflation really starts. So, you know, that's it for this episode. And, you know, you should come back for the next episode as well.